settlement? And in what ways will you be directly involved?
Well, when the first annual report comes up, which is scheduled, I believe, for September of next year, the AMA will be represented, the coalition will be represented and at the table doing that report. In the meantime, while things are being done, such as the selection of the community compliance officer and community liaison, the coalition has been actively involved from the very beginning of that and will go through until it is referred to City Council for the final selection of who gets that contract. The coalition will be involved in helping to be and being a part of the Community Oversight Advisory Board, known as the COAB, and doing other times as we go through when issues come up that are pertaining to the settlement agreement and the parties must discuss or come to agreements, we'll be there. We also have a collaborative agreement with the DOJ and the city as to how we will continue to work together to bring about more just and fair things that happen in the city and changes to the Portland Police Bureau.
And do you think that involvement addresses one of the major concerns of the people of Portland
in
that
the
Independent Police Review Division was not independent enough and not connected enough to the community to actually have an impact on what the police were doing?
Yes, I think it begins to answer the question, for there has been some changes that has been made to the IPR, and some of those are things that have come out as a result of the settlement, as well as some things that have happened as a result of the citizens that have made complaints about the IPR process. So we believe that we will begin to see some improvement there and some continued improvement in the process of having an independent police review.
Well, thank you so much. Again, I've been speaking with Dr. T. Allen Bethel. He is with the Albina Ministerial Alliance Coalition for Justice and Police Reform here in Portland and has been speaking with us about the settlement and the ruling on Friday that Judge Michael Simon made to carry out the settlement agreement between the Department of Justice and the Portland Police. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
This is Jinka Soderberg with KBOO Radio.
This is KBOO Portland. You've just been listening to the volunteer-produced evening news broadcast. Coming up next, Treasures from the Archive. This week on Treasures from the KBOO Archive, we honor one of the great visionary thinkers of our time, Edward Said. He was a professor of comparative literature at Columbia University and an expert on the Israeli occupation of Palestine. Edward Said died 11 years ago in 2003.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Giants of Jazz and Blues, a benefit concert for American music program.
Giants of Jazz and Blues will take place on Friday, September the 5th from 7:30 p.m. to 10 p.m. and features woodwind virtuoso Benny Maupin and acclaimed trumpet player Terrell Stafford, who will be joined by numerous well-known Portland musicians, including Rebecca Kilgore, Andy Stokes, LaRonda Steele, and more.
The concert will be held at the Winningstad Theater, 1111 Southwest Broadway in Portland. Again, that's Giants of Jazz and Blues, a benefit concert for the American Music Program. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio and Sante Aesthetics and Wellness are proud to co-sponsor A Touch of Portland 2014. The event takes place Sunday, September 7th, and is a great way to detox after a long summer. Whether you're getting back from Labor Day weekend or decompressing from the burn, this is a great way to stay healthy through dance, foods, and multiple healing modalities. That's A Touch of Portland, Sunday, September 7th at Northwest 17th and Davis. Go to kboo.fm/touchofportland for more information on this event.
You're tuned to KBOO Portland. Up next, Treasures from the KBOO Archive and featuring Edward Said.
Hi, I'm Brian DeShazer, director of the Pacifica Radio Archives, and welcome to From the Vault, our weekly series that takes our history out of the vault and onto the radio. This week, we honor one of the great visionary thinkers of our time, Edward Said.
I have no power, so I must resort to the tools of education, to writing and speaking.
Edward Said was born in Jerusalem in 1935. His father was an American citizen of Christian Protestant Palestinian origins. Said's family moved to the United States when he was in high school, and he would go on to earn a bachelor's degree at Princeton University and a master's and PhD in English literature at Harvard University. Edward Said became professor of comparative literature at Columbia University in 1963, where he would teach until his death on September 25, 2003. Edward Said would use his dual heritage to help bridge the gap between the West and the Middle East and to improve the Israeli-Palestinian conflict with his acute and sober analysis. Today we will present selections from the Pacifica Radio Archives' 30 years of recordings with Dr. Said. But first we present a special edition of KPFK's Uprising Radio program with host Sonali Kolhatkar and her special guest, Alternative Radio's David Barsamian. Together they honored Dr. Edward Said the day after his passing.
First, we go to the tragic loss of one of the most important progressive intellectuals of our time. The world-renowned Palestinian scholar and writer Professor Edward Said passed away yesterday morning at 7 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. He had suffered leukemia for about 12 years, but continued to speak out and write months and weeks before his death. Said was a university professor of English and comparative literature at Columbia University, but was for many years the Nation magazine's classical music critic as well as contributing writer. Known both for his groundbreaking research in the field of comparative literature and his incisive political commentary, Said was one of the most prominent intellectuals in the United States. His writing regularly appeared in The Guardian of London, Le Monde Diplomatique, and the Arab language daily Al-Hayat, printed in every Arab capital in the world. In 1948, Said and his family were dispossessed from Palestine and settled in Cairo. He came to the United States to attend college and lived in New York for many years, where he also educated himself at Princeton and Harvard. His writing translated into 14 languages, includes 10 books, among them Orientalism, a runner-up in criticism for the National Book Critics Circle Award, The World, The Text and the Critic, Blaming the Victims, Culture and Imperialism, Peace and Its Discontents, Essays on Palestine and the Middle East Peace Process, End of the Peace Process, Oslo and After, and most recently, Power, Politics and Culture. My guest today is author and radio programmer David Barsamian, who has written two books with Edward Said. Before we go to David, we're going to hear some clips of Edward Said in his own words. I created this montage of some of his excerpts from a speech he gave at UCLA this February as a tribute to Edward Said.
Were Iraq to have been the world's largest exporter of oranges, there would have been no concern over its purported possession of weapons of mass destruction or its extraordinarily cruel and tyrannical regime. This is a war planned for resources and for strategic control. To threaten war with such belligerence and such a wasteful deployment of military resources is an abuse of human tolerance and human values. I want to affirm also that no power, no matter how special or how developed or how strong or how urgent its claims of past victimization and present mission, is exempt from accusation and judgment if that government practices such things. And finally, no people or individuals can be singled out as exceptions to these general rules so as to be considered, in fact, liable for such abrogations of human rights as those I've mentioned. The obstacles placed before the Palestinians on a daily, minute-by-minute basis cannot be overestimated. Each of them a conscious, willful abuse of human rights collected from literally everywhere in the history of colonial brutality against indigenous people, but now protracted into several simultaneous regimes of oppression. As I feel as an American that the United States has not been divinely endowed with a special errand into the wilderness, despite what George Bush says, and that its practices are endorsed by God, which I don't believe, I feel it is our moral and intellectual duty to oppose the unjust use of its immense military, economic, and political power abroad for what the George Bush administration claims falsely to be its national security interest. I want to reiterate my conviction here that the specific case of the denial of the human rights of the Palestinian people by the State of Israel, supported by the United States, cannot at all be justified on any of the grounds routinely accepted by far too many individuals and governments who would be the first to object to similar behavior in other cases. I have no power, so I must resort to the tools of education, to writing and speaking.
Edward Said, in his own words at a UCLA lecture this February, he passed away yesterday morning at 7 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. My guest is David Barsamian, a radio producer, journalist, author, and lecturer. He is founder and director of Alternative Radio, heard Fridays here at 3 p.m. on KPFK. He's written two books with the late Professor Edward Said, The Pen and the Sword in 1994, and most recently, Culture and Resistance this year, 2003. Welcome to Uprising, David.
Thank you. Good morning. It's very moving to hear Professor Said's voice and his magical eloquence and ability to articulate in such a brilliant way. His passing is a devastating loss.
What was your reaction, you who have spent so much time with him most recently, especially with the book Culture and Resistance?
Well, I was up all night last night. You know, when someone very close to you dies, you kind of go over every conversation, every meaningful encounter. And I remember the first time I ever met him, almost 20 years ago, in a high school on the east side of New York. He had just given a talk, and someone introduced us and told Edward that, you know, you have to do an interview with David. And so we exchanged telephone numbers, and lo and behold, the very next morning he called me and said, let's do an interview. And so I wound up at his office at Columbia, and I immediately sensed I was in the presence of, you know, an extraordinary intellect, but also a man of great erudition and grace. He was very, very graceful. His love and use of language was simply stunning. And at the beginning of the interview, he kind of intimidated me because he said, you better have some good questions. This wasn't like he was trying to threaten me. He was really looking forward to the excitement of an exchange. He really relished that. And it took me aback for just a second. And then I started talking about Mahmoud Darwish, the Palestinian national poet. And I think because of his love of poetry and culture and art and music, that right away endeared me to him. And after that, we did a whole series of interviews over the years, you know, resulting in two books. And at the culmination of that first interview, I mean, he didn't know me from Adam. He did something which was very, very touching, I thought, and very Eastern, if you will. He walked with me all the way down to the subway stop, you know, to make sure that, you know, I wasn't going to get lost, as if I, a native New Yorker, you know, could get lost. But that was very touching, and to me, it spoke a lot about his generosity and his basic humanity, his kindness. It was quite very evident in all of our exchanges. And the last time I saw him was at a reception in New York for Arundhati Roy. And then he went into the hospital. I knew he was ill, but, you know, he's kind of spoiled us over the years because he's been in and out of hospitals with medical emergencies and crises. And he always bounced back, but not this time. And it's a devastating loss. But I feel, as he always said when I asked him how his health was and how he was doing, he said, you know, it's there, but we've got to press on. And I think that's really important. We've got to press on.
I think what was incredible about his legacy was the contribution that he made, reminding us constantly that the propaganda fed to us, especially about Palestinians, Palestinian Arabs, and Arabs in general, you know, constantly countering that with fact, with information, and with you know, masterful authority. He could tear apart all of the Thomas Friedmans of the world and remind us here in the United States of the humanity of Arabs and of the importance of continuing to struggle and to remain in solidarity. David, you're familiar with his work. Can you, just to remind our listeners, maybe who are, even those who are not familiar with the really intellectual legacy he left behind, his first book, Orientalism, was considered an incredible masterpiece of comparative literature studies and really brought to light some of the racism that was so inherent in literature.
Indeed, Orientalism was a revolutionary work. It really broke new ground in the academy, and the way that knowledge was used and intersected with power to create the Orient, to create the East, to create Islam, which are these reductionist formulaic characterizations of the Middle East, which are extremely misleading and stereotypical. You know, on one hand, you would have the, you know, the belly dancers and the flying carpets and Alibaba and Aladdin and the magic lamp and all of that. And then the juxtaposition, equally false, was the, you know, the lazy, violent Arab who lusts after women, who's dark and mysterious and is just intrinsically violent and threatening. And nowhere in those kinds of characterizations do you have any appreciation for Islamic civilization, for Arab and for Muslim culture, and for the enormous cultural tapestry of the Middle East. I mean, here, you talk about ironies, you know, one of the principal defenders of Islamic civilization in the world today, you know, has been Edward Said, who happens to be a Christian.
Right.
Pointing out the fact that the Middle East has been home to some of the oldest Christian communities in the world, the birthplace of Christianity. And so Said, in Orientalism, and then later with his book Culture and Imperialism, really defined this whole new field of post-colonial studies about how newly independent states and peoples responded to the legacy of imperialism, but crucially in their voice, not in the voice of the white master, not in the voice of the sahib, not in the voice of the you know, plantation owner. So it was the East speaking back to the West in its own voice, and creating this new discourse and breaking down the racist stereotypes of Islam and the Middle East and Arabs. There's a poem that Edward was, you know, it's really hard to talk about him in the past tense because we were very dear friends, and I regard him as a mentor also. But he was very fond of a poem by Aimé César, who is a great Martinican thinker and writer. And it's called At the Rendezvous of Victory. And he says, quoting César, "But the work of man is only just beginning, and it remains to man to conquer all, to conquer all the violence entrenched in the recesses of his passion. And no race possesses the monopoly of beauty, of intelligence, of force. And there is a place for all at the rendezvous of victory." And that was a poem that, you know, he was very, very fond of quoting, and that he used in Culture and Imperialism. And, of course, it was, you know, the whole question of Palestine that Said was so singularly responsible for thrusting onto the public scene. This was the taboo subject that you simply could not talk about. You could not say these words. You could not say Palestine or Palestinian. It was a taboo. It was like talking about incest. And it was because of Said's work, because of his political writings, the culture, the question of Palestine, covering Islam, and all the other books, The Politics of Dispossession, and others, that he was able to get the Palestinian question, front and center. And it was extremely difficult, because as he says, how many friends avoid the subjects? How many colleagues want none of Palestine's controversy? How many liberals have time for Bosnia and Chechnya and Somalia and Rwanda and South Africa and Nicaragua and Vietnam and human and civil rights everywhere on earth, but not for Palestine and Palestinians? And he always spoke out about the justice of the Palestinian cause, no matter how uncomfortable it made people think. And it took a tremendous amount of courage on his part. His office was firebombed. He and his family received many death threats over the years. He was vilified in the most vitriolic and vituperative language in the mainstream press. He was called the Professor of Terror, magazine articles defaming him in commentary in the New Republic and elsewhere. So it was a very difficult struggle, but it was a principled struggle that he made. And I think his legacy is a great one. And we need to cherish this man's courage as we build on it and go forward, press ahead.
And he has left behind many books, including the two books that he did with you, the latest one, Culture and Resistance, as well as, of course, an archive of his speeches here preserved at in Pacifica and throughout some of the other areas that he spoke in and other media institutions that did give him a voice, albeit those on the progressive edge of things. Although he did certainly make it into, once in a while, into the mainstream media. It is certainly a great loss. David, very briefly, Culture and Resistance is your book with him, Conversations with Edward Said. Very briefly, can you describe the book for our listeners?
Well, it really intersects with what you're doing with your program, Uprising, which is Intifada in Arabic. It's how culture, how art, music, poetry, literature, all breathe prana. They breathe life into resistance. There cannot be a resistance, a principled resistance, that lacks a culture, the humanizing element of culture. So it's all about that. It's about the struggle for Palestine. It's about how the media manipulate and control public opinion. There's a lot of information about Iraq. Our last interview was recorded in late February. We were talking as if the Iraq war had already happened, because it was obvious it was going to happen. And Said predicted that it was going to be a catastrophe. And indeed, it has worked out that way. So it's a book I'm very proud of. I'm really glad I had the privilege of working with him and sharing his ideas. I'm just the vehicle for his ideas, and so I hope people will look at this work and other works by Edward Said.
Power, Politics, and Cultures is Edward Said's own latest book. Well, David Barsamian, thank you so much for joining us today and sharing some of your experiences with the late Edward Said.
Thank you, Sonali.
That was Sonali Kolhatkar, host of KPFK's Uprising Radio, interviewing alternative radio's David Barsamian. This program was recorded on September 26, 2003, the day following the death of Dr. Edward Said. Next, we will hear an excerpt from one of the earliest recordings of Dr. Said in the Pacifica Archives. On the five-year anniversary of the June 10, 1967 Six-Day War in the Middle East, Dr. Edward Said sat down with WBAI producers in New York City to discuss the current situation between the Palestinians and the Israelis.
I think anybody who argues that, and as I seem to have been arguing, anybody who argues that the Palestinian resistance as such is finished is really quite wrong. I think it should be said that the Palestinian resistance in its past form, in the form that we've seen it take in the last 4 or 5 years, is undergoing a major change. It may be transformed. It may, in fact, die. But this doesn't mean that the question of the Palestinian resistance is over. There is a good deal of sentiment, obviously subterranean sentiment, in the West Bank and in Gaza, but much more explicit elsewhere in the Arab world and outside the Arab world, which keeps alive the very spirit of Palestinian resistance. So I think that what we're really watching is a transformation in political structures and political organizations, but let us say the sentiment and the idea behind resistance will remain. And I think it's the case in the West Bank.
It seemed to me that actions such as the recent one at the Tel Aviv airport were reflective of a kind of a weakness of the Palestinian resistance movement. I wonder if you saw it that way, and secondly, where you see this transformation headed.
Well, I think on the question, first of all, of the events of last week, which are, I think, deplorable and wrenching to anyone who has any involvement in the area. I think, though, that it should be said from the outset that the history of this conflict is a peculiar one. I mean, the Arab-Israeli or the Palestinian-Israeli conflict is a peculiar one in that it's been marked from the very beginning with acts of dramatic and wanton terror on both sides. And so I think this is another episode in this, and I think it's probably true to say, too, that it does argue a fairly large measure of what you and I would call desperation. I think, though, that these acts are liable to lead nowhere in the long run. I don't think that they will accomplish very much. I think they will probably come to an end as a stronger and more coherent political line develops, as I think it probably will.
And what do you expect it to pass into?
Well, I think, in the first place, you have to remember that up until 1970, the Palestinians, by and large, firmly believed that their cause was the Arab cause. They did believe that the Arabs stood ready to support them in anything that they might do. And it was a very dramatic and important moment, I think, in 1970, in September of 1970, when the Jordanian army was unleashed on the Palestinians with a tacit cooperation, let's say, and supervision in a very abstract way, by the Americans and the Israelis, that this illusion of Arab unity, which is one of the besetting illusions of the Arab world, was shattered once and for all. So I think now the role of the Palestinians is to identify exactly what their objectives are, who their friends are, who their allies are, and who their enemies are. And I think this is the phase we're passing through right now. And obviously, it's a very disorganized and difficult phase, and it's probably a great many changes will take place before these identifications are made and programs geared to these alignments appear.
The formation of the modern state of Israel in 1948 was followed by the formation of the United Nations refugee camps for displaced Arabs. Between September 16th and 18th, 1982, two of these camps, Sabra and Shatila, were surrounded by Israeli troops while Lebanese militia murdered roughly 2,000 civilian men, women, and children. The next day, Edward Said spoke out against the inhumanity of the slaughter on Pacifica Radio.
It seems to me that what happened, judging by the reports that have now come out of Lebanon, both from the U.S., some of the U.S. media, and from the European media, which I've been monitoring, for example, the BBC, that the Israelis knew perfectly well on Wednesday, and certainly by Thursday, that by letting in the people of Sa'd Haddad from South Lebanon, they're stationed approximately 50 miles from Beirut, and they came through, they couldn't have come through in strength, a battalion, without Israeli knowledge. They came through to the two camps, Sabra and Shatila, and the reports in today's paper indicate further that the Israelis were informed, the cabinet was informed, by reporters on Thursday. And the reporters in Beirut said that Israeli troops were providing these militias with flares to light up their work. And and that at the same time Israeli soldiers were standing off on the side guarding the entrances to the camps, which they controlled as of Tuesday night, and listening to Simon Garfunkel music. This coming from a government that claims it has no responsibility is an outrage. First of all, not only upon humanity, but also upon any conception that one might have of the truth. Because Saad Haddad, who's a cashiered officer in the Lebanese, from the Lebanese army, has been quite literally, and this is not a figure of speech or an exaggeration that might be ascribed to metaphors, he is quite literally a creature of Israel. He has been supported, his men have been clothed, not to say fed and armed, by the Israelis. He never operates without an Israeli colonel at his side, and all the interviews that have been done with him have shown the same. And it is also very probable that Israeli officers were involved to some degree in the massacre. This was done, in my opinion, clearly to make it impossible for Palestinians not only to function politically and independently as a national movement in Lebanon and elsewhere, the West Bank, but also to make it impossible for them to live. And moreover, that what went on in Beirut, it is now reported, is only part of a similar process that has been taking place in South Lebanon, where there's an even larger concentration of Palestinians. So what we have before us is a horror story that is made even more horrible by the fact that the Israelis and their supporters claim that Israel is not only a democracy, but is the outcome of what was wreaked upon the European Jews by the Nazis. So it's not like it's bad enough that massacres take place in the Middle East and one must condemn them, as one condemned, for example, the Syrian massacre of the citizens of Hama in February of this year. But what makes it worse is that these are the very people, the survivors of one of the most horrible episodes in the history of mankind, who seem to have been gathering their strength and forces in order to perpetrate on another people what was perpetrated on them. And this, in full view of the evening news, of the spectators of American and European and Western television as a whole, and in full view of a U.S. government which has made possible, by supplying them with arms, I'm convinced, for example, that the actual bullets that killed these innocent women and children, as a kind of didactic lesson in how not to oppose Israel and Zionism, were supplied by the United States. These were American bullets. Now, you know, one doesn't want to go on about who's responsible and what guilt is there to be apportioned, but I think the mind is simply boggled at the extent of this disaster. And the last point I want to make, it seems to me to be illogical, a clear-cut, for those of us who've been saying it for a long time, a clear-cut development out of the policy of the Zionist movement, not all of it, of course, but that which has now taken the ascendancy, Begin and the psychopath, who is called Sharon, whose policy from the beginning is to pretend that the Palestinians were not there when they first came to Palestine and colonized the place. And its direct outcome is when Begin on June the 8th stood in front of the Knesset and referred to the Palestinians as two-legged beasts. First you say they're not there, then you convert them into animals and terrorists, and then, of course, you kill them, not only with impunity, but with the blessings of the so-called liberal, free, Western, democratic world.
You are listening to the Pacifica Radio Archives recordings of Dr. Edward Said on From the Vault. For more information or to get a copy of this program or to browse the other programs in our series, visit us online at fromthevaultradio.org or call the archives toll-free at 1-800-735-0230. You can research our collection at pacificaradioarchives.org. And now to conclude our special profile in Courage of Dr. Edward Said, one of the great visionary thinkers of the 20th century, we present one of his last public addresses. On February 20th, 2003, he delivered this speech before a packed house on the campus of University of California, Los Angeles.
This is a very fraught moment to be speaking about human rights in the Middle East, and those of the Palestinian people in particular. But it does seem to be in some ways a symbolically useful time for the purposes of my lecture. The United States of America has already sent a hugely intimidating military force to various Arab and non-Arab countries in the region surrounding Iraq. The frankly imperial idea behind that is, on one level at least, to disarm Iraq forcibly and also to change its dreadful regime. The rest of the international community, not least among them the Arab countries of the region, as well as some of the other permanent members of the Security Council, has been expressing varying degrees of disquiet and occasionally of urgent disapproval. Although it's also clear that most Arab governments are too unpopular and intimidated to do anything but go along. Certainly it's the case that no one outside Iraq has suggested any concern, any iota of concern about Saddam Hussein and his government. It is the people of Iraq who stand to suffer the most and whose doubly and triply miserable fate is of the deepest interest to people all over the world, although you wouldn't know it from the American media. I'm sorry to say that none of this has had the slightest effect on what is an impervious, not to say granitic, will on the part of a tiny number of members of George Bush's administrations who plan to go forward with a war, among whose stated intentions is the unilateral wish to bring American-style democracy to Iraq and the Arab world, redrawing maps, overturning governments and states and modes of life on a fantastically wide scale in the process. That all this has very little to do with the enhancements of human rights in a part of the world especially rife with their abuse, in my opinion, is patently obvious. Were Iraq to have been the world's largest exporter of oranges, there would have been no concern over its purported possession of weapons of mass destruction or its extraordinarily cruel and tyrannical regime. This is a war planned for resources and for strategic control, and whether or not it occurs, there is still some small room for doubt about that, given the huge number of protests all over the world, a deeply encouraging sign. The U.S., or its government, has at very least asserted its strategic dominance over the center of the world's largest known energy reserves, from the Gulf to the Caspian Sea, and plans to reshape the area by pacifying threats to its dominance in countries like Syria, Iran, and some of the Gulf Emirates. To threaten war with such belligerence and such a wasteful deployment of military resources is an abuse of human tolerance and human values. That it might in the end turn out to be only a display rather than an actual use of force only deepens anxiety about the kind of world we are moving toward. Note also that by the end of the decade, China will be importing as much oil as the United States, and by 2025, the United States will need to import a full 75% of its oil needs from the Gulf region in particular. As against those mighty facts, whether people are prevented from getting an education or from being allowed to move, express themselves, and organize freely without fear either of intimidation, collective punishment, or assassination, may seem therefore like relatively humdrum, if not entirely trivial, issues. But they do pertain with a frightening parallelism to both the people of Palestine and the people of Iraq. In both cases, my point here is to assert the universal applicability of human rights to those unfortunate people, given that since World War II, there has grown up an impressive, even formidable, worldwide consensus that each individual or collectivity, no matter his or her color, ethnicity, religion, or culture, is to be protected from such horrific practices as starvation, torture, the forced transfer of populations,
religious discrimination, humiliation, extrajudicial political assassinations, land expropriation, and all manner of similar cruel and unusual punishment. I want to affirm also that no power, no matter how special or how developed or how strong or how urgent its claims of past victimization and present mission, is exempt from accusation and judgment if that government practices such things. And finally, no people or individuals can be singled out as exceptions to these general rules so as to be considered, in fact, liable for such abrogations of human rights as those I've mentioned. We live in a secular historical world. History is the product of human labor, choice, and will. Nothing transcendental or divine can supersede that truth or suspend the consequences that flow from its application. There simply is no convincing way to assert special claims whose origin is divine edict, claims that supposedly legitimate high altitude or smart bombing, or the use of 60-ton bulldozers to demolish the houses of poor and defenseless people who don't happen to belong to the correct religion or race. Just as I feel as an American that the United States has not been divinely endowed with a special errand into the wilderness, despite what George Bush says, and that its practices are endorsed by God, which I don't believe, I feel it is our moral and intellectual duty to oppose the unjust use of its immense military, economic, and political power abroad for what the George Bush administration claims falsely to be its national security interests. I have no power, so I must resort to the tools of education, to writing and speaking. By the same token, I want to reiterate my conviction here that the specific case of the denial of the human rights of the Palestinian people by the State of Israel, supported by the United States, cannot at all be justified on any of the grounds routinely accepted by far too many individuals and governments who would be the first to object to similar behavior in other cases. So far from Israel and the Palestinians being a special case of unusual and exceptional circumstances, I think the exact opposite is true, that because Palestine is perhaps of all places on earth the one most densely saturated with cultural and religious significance, precisely that reality makes it an instance of universality thwarted and flouted, the universality of human coexistence, human acceptance of the other, and human construction of a just and fair society for all, and certainly not only some of its residents. The point is that no state at all, is in my opinion entitled legitimately to object to these formulations. And certainly no leader can state unarguably, for example, as George Bush has, that the United States is good and its enemies evil, or as General Sharon has announced, and I quote now, that we are placing no restrictions on our operations in the Palestinian territories. Israel is under no pressure. No one is criticizing us, he says, or has the right to do so, end of quote. I would submit that such sweeping statements of higher purpose and extraordinary impunity must be opposed and intellectually dismantled for the thuggish balderdash that such pronouncements really are. Especially if they're intended to cover or explain or excuse or somehow justify barbaric devastation and vast ruin. Yet the contrast between the immensely powerful and the relatively powerless is not so simple, since the great outcry all over the world against the U.S. war today, the unilateral U.S. war, and the felt need by even government spokesmen, American government spokespeople, to reiterate a general American commitment to democracy and human rights does in fact reveal a profoundly profound worldly awareness that aside from comfort and convenience, human beings today expect to be respected, their requirements for a decent life met, their wish recognized not to be tortured or detained unlawfully, their concern for their children and their livelihoods accepted despite the supposedly higher priorities asserted by great power. All these, in theory at least, are rarely challenged head-on and considered to be human entitlements, even if such terrible abstractions as are used today, the national interest, the national unity, and so on, are affirmed as superseding individual rights. I don't believe they do and can never be allowed to. This unattractive and unacceptable argument certainly now prevails in the U.S., where education and history, for instance, has become a profoundly ideological battleground between proponents of a kind of heroic, primitive, white American nationalism and the much more sensible advocates of the multicultural, multiracial reality stressed, for instance, in his work by the prominent historian Howard Zinn. This is, after all, an immigrant society, and to pretend that it's a kind of an English derivation exclusively from England is a preposterous mistake. This other American history that Zinn has looked at includes a bitter legacy of domestic slavery, imperial conquest, and terrible class inequality. So the universally widespread conviction that everyone on earth deserves a modicum of human rights has only a symbolic moral power, perhaps too ill-endowed to take on so redoubtable a force as American global reach and its all too numerous local henchmen and fearsomely neoconservative spokespersons who want so-called American values to rule the world, resistance and objections notwithstanding. So to speak about Palestinian rights in so skewed a context, therefore, may seem quixotic. And certainly the current impression that Israel and the United States have borne all before them in their stubbornly ingrained hostility to full Palestinian self-determination reinforces the superficial impression. But I want to argue that is not at all there is to the whole truth. There are other accomplishments and realities also to be noted with positive approbation and admiration. During my own lifetime, Palestinians, since the climactic events of 1948, when their society was destroyed and two-thirds of the population dispersed by the Zionist forces of the time, and Israel was established, Palestinians have gone from the status of non-persons to that of a universally acknowledged national collectivity, that is, a people, by virtue not of force of arms, but of other means, some of which I want to rehearse here. If for now the Palestinians are still a stateless people, dispossessed and for the most part exiled, it is because by those very unmilitary means, some of which are the mobilized force of memory, the power of images, and the heroism and ingenuity of sheer persistence, Palestinians embody perhaps the most visible and certainly the most universal case of human rights abuses on earth today. There's no desire on my part to be fetishistically competitive about such a claim, so I won't go on about it any further. But I will ask you to keep in mind that a great deal of the agitation all over the world about the U.S., the upcoming U.S. war in Iraq, is also concerned with self-determination for the Palestinian people. I want, therefore, to talk about the visibility not only of the Palestinians' presence as victims of injustice and human rights denial, but of the equal force they represent on the world stage of a wrong that must be righted. In an extremely suggestive lecture, the Welsh political philosopher Ken Booth draws attention to the existence of what he calls a growing number of transcultural, moral, and political solidarities that have acted the part of what he calls agents that have gone transcended sovereignty. That is to say, actors and institutions not bound by the borders between countries that have defined the international system since the Peace of Westphalia. That focus seems to me an excellent way of characterizing the overall human achievement of the Palestinian people in the period after 1948 until the present.
Note that in all the many amazingly different places, conditions, and polities that the approximately 7.5 million Palestinians now live in, and count them, there are the Palestinian citizens of Israel as a people under military occupation in the West Bank and Gaza since 1967, as refugees and stateless persons in several Arab countries, as refugees with various acquired nationalities scattered all over the world, including America, and as members of a dispossessed people, Palestinians have developed a moral and political solidarity with each other. Nothing less, in fact, than a national identity that it has been the goal of Israel to deny, obliterate, and refuse to acknowledge as sovereign. To argue backwards for a moment, let me cite only one recent example of what I mean by denial and a refusal to acknowledge. It was precisely that Israeli refusal that flawed the Oslo process that began in 1993. From the moment it was undertaken, and it was undertaken, alas, with, in my opinion, unqualified and unprepared Palestinian representatives who were delegated with a task which was designed not to restore, but to further postpone and deflect the fulfillment of Palestinian aspirations. In this, neither Israel nor the United States, since 1993, was moved by an acknowledgement of past injustices, nor by a spirit of contrition or of reconciliation. With their batteries of legal experts, backed by the disproportional military weight of both countries, and at the same time as more than double the pre-existing number of settlements were being created on Palestinian land and more human rights abused, Israel and the United States divided and subdivided, occupied, and ever-diminishing bits of Palestinian territory into smaller and less viable units for the unfortunate Palestinian Authority to take over and rule. All under the misleading, not to say willfully deceptive, rubric of the peace process. Was there ever any other intention than to draw it out and colonize more Palestinian land? Not peace at all, not peace at all, but pacification for a time. The Oslo Accords were, alas, far too much of a peace, with several prior decades of Palestinian dispossession, house demolitions, land expropriations, and attacks on civil society. As against that, there has been, as I said a moment ago, a moral and political solidarity building up between Palestinians all over the world. Some of it was evident in the past week's worldwide protests. One of its manifestations, and perhaps not its most significant one, is that today, for example, there is a Palestinian cinema, and with it a kind of transnational visibility of the Palestinian person that would have been unthinkable three decades ago. Visual symbols have played an extraordinary role in this reappearance of the Palestinian individual after years of absence and programmed national effacement. I don't want to rehearse here the steps taken by Israel inside former Palestine to systematically obliterate the centuries-old Arab presence along with its symbols and structures. I've described some of these on the juridical level, so far as the taking over of land and property was concerned, in my book, The Question of Palestine, where I discuss how Palestinian land, 90% of the territory of Mandatory Palestine, which was owned by Arabs, who were then kicked out, was redefined as Jewish national land in the years between 1948 and 1950. Because the overall plan was to start Israel as if afresh, a state rising from nothing to take its place among the nations. In the affirmations of its renewed millennial identity, Israel managed for quite a while to remove the traces of Palestinian life for the most part, even though, of course, a large number of those traces who remained as a remnant of people despite the expulsions of 1948 were there as a humbled and scarcely perceptible presence, ruled inside Israel by military government until 1966. Even so apparently innocent and objective a science and discipline, such as archaeology thereafter, was complicit in the making over of the land and its markers as if there had never been any Arabs there. This is chillingly described by Nadia Abulhaj in her recent book, Facts on the Ground, Archaeological Practice and Territorial Self-Fashioning in Israeli Society. Her argument is that in the process of providing Israel with an ancient, objectivized history visible in archaeological evidence, the traces of other, more historically adjunct histories were ignored or simply moved away. What remained became an evidence of a kind of essential Israeliteness, giving the state a pedigree in a long distant past with the intervening cultures and peoples pushed aside. That's archaeology. Moreover, in a trilogy of powerful books entitled A Land Without People, first one, the second, The Expulsion of the Palestinians, and the third one, Imperial Israel and the Palestinians, The Politics of Expansion, 1967 to 2000, the Palestinian-Israeli scholar Nour Masalha has unearthed both the theory and practice of emptying the land of Israel of its indigenous inhabitants. Much of the pre-state Zionist ideology that mobilized Eastern European communities for the trek to mandatory Palestine was premised on the virtual absence of inhabitants on what was often depicted as either a completely empty or a hopelessly arid land awaiting redemption. Later, or in some cases simultaneously with that contention, when the discovery of actual Palestinians could no longer be deferred or denied, there was a concerted effort to devise ways of spiriting them away. Transfer was the main euphemism for that fantasy, for which the war of 1948 provided field commanders and Ben-Gurion himself with a rich opportunity. As I said, two-thirds of the Arab population of Palestine was expelled, about almost 800,000 people. All these things are amply attested to in the Israeli military archive as combed assiduously by a number of Jewish as well as numerous Arab researchers, including Masalha himself. Since 1967, when Israel occupied the rest of historical Palestine, the desire to efface and or repress what has remained of an institutionalized Palestinian life in the cities and villages of the West Bank and Gaza has remained an often explicitly stated Israeli goal, recently hidden inside the polemics of a war for Israel's survival and a defense against terrorism. But whether its new Jewish citizens liked it or not, Israel was always and still is encumbered by Palestinian memory, which is one of my themes here. It's not as if a whole existence of a people can be easily wiped away like footprints in the sand. The sheer banality of such a possibility is too obvious to require more comment here. What I would like to note, however, is that as the resourceful Palestinian-Israeli sociologist Ahmed Saadi has shown in an excellent piece of historical and social synthesis, the more Israel has unilaterally exerted its tremendous force to bury the Palestinian past, as it were, there has been a painstaking collective and yet uncoordinated Palestinian memory that has maintained Palestinian history since the disaster or catastrophe of 1948, as a tremendously potent site of memory. Cinema is one result. What has remained of the vastly dispersed and disjunctive fragments of history since 1948 have been painstakingly collected over time as objects of memory, such objects as house keys, title deeds, photographs, letters, newspaper clippings, embroideries, and so forth. And through film, fiction, poetry, oral discourse, critical and political analysis, and scholarship, significant or traumatic collective experiences like the Deir Yassin, Kufr Qasim, Sabra and Shatila massacres, and more recently the devastation at the Jenin refugee camp, the significant episodes of Palestinian suffering have been preserved along with a national life that bore and outlived them. I remember writing in 1982 that whenever one of us during the Israeli invasion of Lebanon, that whenever one of us had an opportunity to speak plainly, there was a felt requirement to start narrating the collective national story as if from the beginning. No freestanding Palestinian narrative was available that could place before the world the chronological sequence of dispossession and catastrophic loss that has so disfigured and mutilated Palestinian life. Such a sequence has been interdicted in all sorts of ways, far too many times by such things as the carting off by Israeli soldiers of Palestinian archives from Beirut during the 1982 invasion. And only the other day, the Israeli occupation army similarly removed records, computers, hard drives, statistics from Palestinian offices at the Central Bureau of Statistics, the Ministry of Education, the Ministry of Health, and elsewhere in the West Bank. Whether this was meant to put a stop to Palestinian national life just short of full ethnic cleansing, I don't want to speculate here. But that such procedures are of a piece with claims that Israel is fighting for its life, and that in occupying and destroying everything possible by tanks, bulldozers, F-16s, and Apache helicopters, it is defending itself against terrorists who happen to have no army or viable defense or means of waging war of any description, that seems totally obvious. In any event, the great narrative of Palestinian life hasn't yet been achieved, or for that matter, written, any more than the fulfillment of its logical national aspirations have been fulfilled. Although it seems just as obvious to every Palestinian that there is no regression, no flagging, no turning away among Palestinians everywhere on this inexorable drive. Despite all the difficulties, a Palestinian nation in exile or in waiting has emerged with an unmistakable outline and personality of its own. The vast network of institutions, groups, and associations scattered all over the world that sustains the continuity of Palestinian national life is an amazing thing. It has drawn not only on the mobilized energies of Palestinians everywhere, but also on the very widespread commitment to them of their friends, allies, and comrades all over the world. The obstacles placed before the Palestinians on a daily, minute-by-minute basis cannot be overestimated. Each of them, a conscious, willful abuse of human rights collected from literally everywhere in the history of colonial brutality against indigenous people, but now protracted into several simultaneous regimes of oppression. Yesterday, 11 Palestinians